So this is going to be part two, a continuation of the talk I gave last Sunday, and continuing on with the scripture of great wisdom. And in terms of the actual scripture, we've only gotten through the first sentence, basically. Should be fine, should work quite readily for those of you who weren't here last Sunday to follow along. We will cover the five skandhas. So at the top of page two, we have the reference to, well, let me backtrack just a moment to put it in context. So basically, Kanzan Bosatsu, Kanzan Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the golden statue on the front altar, the white statue here in the common room up on the bookshelf over there, basically representing great compassion and meditating very, very deeply. Great compassion basically experiences something, knows something, and it has to do with the five skandhas. What we covered last time was the first of the five skandhas, namely form. And what's interesting is that the Theravadin school of Buddhism, which came first, and then the Mahayana school of Buddhism, the branch of Buddhism that went to China, Korea, Japan, and also Tibet. So the Mahayana school and the Theravadin school, they have slightly different, you could sort of say slightly different areas of focus relative to the five skandhas. And I'll try to draw that out as we go. So the skandha of form, it initially had to do with basically the form of, you know, having a body. So our physical body. That's originally from Theravadin Buddhism. In Mahayana Buddhism, anything that has a form, a physical form, has a skandha of, you know, of form. So a rock has form to it. You know, it's a physical thing, the chairs that you're sitting in, and so on. So already from Theravadin Buddhism to Mahayana Buddhism, what you're doing is kind of broadening that understanding of what form is. And as I mentioned last time, the skandha of form, our physical bodies have, I'm going to say five senses for the moment, and then we'll add the sixth one shortly. But we have the five senses. So we have sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and then body in the sense of physical sensations. So what's interesting is that the skandha of form contains the five senses that I've just mentioned. But because we have five senses, we have the second skandha, which is sensation. And in this case, sensation specifically means the things that arise in the five senses. Now, a rock does not, we're not going to get deeply philosophical here. We'll keep it kind of practical. As best I know, rocks do not have any senses. And even if they did, it wouldn't be relevant to the training we need to do. So a rock, a table, a chair only has one skandha out of the five. There's some areas where you might impute consciousness into other things, but again, it's like we're humans and we're needing to do our training. So sensations are specifically talking about anything that we sense from the five sense organs. So obviously just things that we see, things that we hear, taste, smell, and then things that we touch with our bodies, tactile sensation. We can feel pain. It's really interesting. You can close your eyes, and the majority of people with their eyes closed can touch the tip of their nose with their index finger, or get really, really close. There's a physical sense that we have of our body position. And we can feel pain, and we can also feel cold and hot. So we're going to get to experience the sensation of hot later on today. Hopefully it won't be too hot for all of you. And we know that other living organisms, they also have sense organs of various kinds, and they would have sensations. So they might have two skandhas. So the third skandha, so we've got form, sensation, and then thought. And what's interesting is that, so Buddhism has, as far as I know, both in Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism, there's the teaching that we basically perceive thoughts. We sense thoughts, if you want to put it that way. Oh, so there must be a sense organ that detects thoughts. And without getting splitting hairs or getting too technical, you know, brain slash mind. So what's interesting about thoughts, and oftentimes this is the way we teach meditation too, is that, so for example, one of your sense organs while you're meditating, your ears will hear something. At the same time, your thoughts will say, or they will sort of print out, so to speak, oh, that's the neighbor's dog barking. So there's a real relationship between thoughts and our sensations. And what's interesting is, so you get at the level of thoughts, you get the mind basically telling you, printing out, if you will, what you're sensing through one of your sense organs. I'm seeing Nancy, I'm seeing all of you sitting here. Another interesting thing about the thought skanda is that anything that we have sensed in the past can arise in the mind also as a thought. You know, sometimes we can get memories coming up very vividly where we'll actually have sensations coming up too, quite strongly. But we certainly will get things coming up in our minds. And that's what the thought skanda is referring to. And in one other aspect of that, which is quite interesting, is that I could say, visualize a red tomato. And you can bring that to mind also. And as far as I know, there's no red tomato in this room whatsoever, but thought-wise, we can bring that up. The first three skandhas, the way we've been talking about them up to this point, is that we have a form, we have a physical body that has sense organs, and the mind, in the way of bringing up thoughts, can, you know, kind of basically tell us what all of those things are. And the mind is very, very active or very integral to, you know, the other five senses and our physical body. Interestingly enough, there's an additional thing that we as human beings can also do, which is, and this is adding the fourth skanda, which is activity. As we've translated it, activity is that, oh, because I have the skanda of form, because I have sense organs, because I have thoughts, a mind, I can actually do things with those. And that's what activity is talking about. I can do physical activities. I can use my sense organs to look at something, listen to something, feel something, so on. Those four skandhas are covering quite a lot of bases there. But according to Buddhism, we need a fifth one. And once we add the fifth one, that covers all of our bases as a human being, namely consciousness. And as I understand it, in the context of the scripture of great wisdom, consciousness has to do with the fact that, and it's been implicit in everything I've been saying already, that I'm aware, I'm conscious that I have a form, a body. I'm conscious that I have senses. I'm conscious, of seeing things, hearing things, touching things. I'm conscious of, I'm aware of thoughts arising, either thoughts that are of experiences of the senses from the past, the present, or I'm just going to kind of imagine them, and so on. So basically, as I was saying last time, historically in Buddhism, they've sometimes had six skandhas, sometimes they've had four skandhas. We seem to have settled on five at the time being and have been stable with that for some time, certainly in the Soto Zen tradition. And the five skandhas are basically, last time I checked into it, it's like, yeah, that pretty much, anything that I experience as a person, anything I can imagine experiencing as a person, these five skandhas seem to cover everything. So one approach you could actually take is just noticing at any time what's going on, and you could say which skandhas are involved. I think I jokingly mentioned last Sunday in anticipation of this group of cyclists coming. So I've been up since 4 this morning. I got up at 4:30, and I told you that my talk would probably be better because I talk a lot better, give a lot better talks when my brain's not working as well. So I don't think it's completely offline, but maybe my thought skandha is a little less than it might normally be, which seems to, in many cases, actually things seem to go better when that's going on. So everything I've just said and everything you can kind of bring to mind, think about, etc., that's what's contained on the top of page 2, where it says the skandhas five. So basically, Kanzan Bodhisattva is saying, in deepest meditation in the seeing things very, very deeply, very clearly, seeing things as they are, makes this statement that they know that the five skandhas, as they are, in their self nature. Okay, we have to unpack self nature. What's that talking about? So I'm going to contend that self nature, as the scripture of great wisdom contends, there's no such thing as self nature. So it must not operate at all. But we can come at it from a different angle and say that it does operate in a certain way too. So basically, self-nature is referring to, I guess I'm pondering about the word nature. It's like you can come up with the question of what is a rock's nature? What is a chair's nature? What is a dog's nature? What is a tree's nature? What is a person's nature? In bringing it up that way, it's sort of saying, what is this? What at the heart of it is going on? What's operable, or kind of what's happening? Self-nature is actually referring to, and this goes back all the way to the beginnings of Buddhism, and just a lot of discussions, even historically, a lot of debates that were going on and so on. And a self, what a self means is something that is substantial in the sense of it's unchanging, it's its own entity. It sort of stands alone through thick and thin, through the unfolding of time. There is still this discrete, unchanging entity or thing. So basically what's being said in this sentence is, if we examine, if we look at, based on our own personal experience, if we look at the five skandhas, if we look at our bodies, the sensations we experience, the thoughts we experience, the things that we do, and, you know, the consciousness, the awareness of all of that, within all of that, we're saying, is there a self nature in there? Is there something within all of those five skandhas? Is there some nature there which is a separate, discrete, standalone entity, kind of reality that just doesn't change at all? So Kanzan Bosatsu, Avalokiteshvara, Great Compassionate, is basically saying, she's answering that question. And the first of the three answers are the five skandhas relative to, in terms of a self nature, are void. What's the phrase? Null and void. If you look within the five skandhas, if you look within your five skandhas, Buddhism says there is nothing in there at all that doesn't change, that is just kind of this. This is where we get the teaching in Buddhism that says there is no self. And that means, in that context, there isn't something about how you're constituted in the five skandhas that's going to last, that's not going to change, that's going to carry on. Each one of you probably would have a variety of reactions if you were here at 5 o'clock this morning and the controlled mayhem that was going on and just the sheer mass of people that were here, and now they're not. Things just changed. They're just not here anymore, and I more than likely will never see any of them ever again. And, you know, that is one very vivid example of what's being talked about here. I could hear things at 5 this morning. I could see things. You know, we had the espresso machine going, which was a very big feature, by the way. So I could smell things. Now what I see, now what I hear, smell, etc., is different. And so kind of reflect on that, look on that, you know, similarly to Avalokiteshvara, who's looking very, very deeply, very, very broadly in terms of time and space, and saying that, you know, looking within all of these skandhas, no, there isn't anything that doesn't keep changing. Now, if we were to stop right at the end of the word void, that would be kind of a bummer. And I think that just sort of in people's kind of common everyday experience of Buddhism, from, you know, they may not be interested necessarily in practicing it, but they have people, friends who do it, and they hear about it and so on. And most of them, what they've heard is just the void part, the null and void part. It's all empty. You know, and sometimes people even say, you don't exist. Yes, but there's a little bit of a important nuance about that phrase that we're going into right now. But it continues with two more words. There isn't a self nature. There isn't a fixed, unchanging, everlasting aspect of you in those five skandhas. But they're also the words unstained and pure. So if we unpack those over the next while, we'll actually finish the first sentence of the Scripture of Great Wisdom. Basically, the first sentence is kind of like the summary of the entire scripture. If you start getting a feel for that, then what we go through after that is just kind of fine-tuning. It's just adding a few more details to it. Unstained and pure. I think one of the things that that's addressing, pointing to, is that I think all of us who come to a spiritual practice of any kind, and when we have this sense that there is what this hope, this promise, this sense of there being something more than the life that we know already, we look at our lives or aspects of our lives. We may come to a spiritual practice or kind of be on a journey of exploring different spiritual practices because we have a sense that our life as it is now, or there have been aspects of our life that are just getting to the point where it's like, surely there must be something better, or I don't seem to be somehow getting things right, or we may be going through very, very difficult times that can be quite challenging or painful. Most spiritual practices have, what we've talked about off and on. It might be time to look at it more carefully in the near future too, once we get into autumn or something. Most spiritual practices have the precepts of some sort where they actually talk about, how we conduct ourselves in body, speech, and mind. And when we're taught that about there being kind of cause and effect based on what we do, what we say, what we think, we might bring to mind times in our lives where we've behaved in ways that we really wish we hadn't. We've lived our lives in ways that we wish we hadn't. And I think that oftentimes what can happen is we, depending on the spiritual tradition, we can kind of snowball with that a little bit too much and think of ourselves as being kind of a miserable worm for all that we've gotten up to in our lives, or just this horrible person because of what we've done in the past. And remember, everything again that we're talking about here, I've just mentioned, we can sort of parse it out into the various skandhas. This is the attitude of mind I had. These are the actual physical things I did that affected, my body or, my sensations and so on. So this second word, unstained, is actually really, really significant. It's saying anything you've gotten up to, everything you've gotten up to, in terms of what you've done, what you've said, what you've thought, fundamentally, it's unstained and pure. And here's where we need to bring in a whole. I mean, you're all welcome to right now, just suddenly in deepest meditation, just it's like, oh, of course, Reverend Hugh, that's obvious. Everything's void and unstained and pure. Okay, but if that hasn't happened in the 2 seconds that I just gave you. And one very, very senior monk, he said, enlightenment happens in an instant. There are probably lots of instances in a second. So I was very generous, actually. To help us struggling five skanda beings, it can be of help to bring in one of many metaphors. So the skandhas are always changing. Your experience throughout your day is always changing. This changeableness is very analogous to waves on an ocean. They just kind of come and go all the time. But the water of the ocean, you can have a big wave, you can have a little wave, you can have no waves occasionally. Doesn't do a thing to the water at all. The essence of the water, the nature of the water is unchanging. And so it's been used for centuries now, the imagery, the sort of the conceptual framework. So we're kind of talking about the thought level here of describing what's being talked about here in this first sentence as the skandhas are like the waves of the ocean. But regardless of how the waves are, regardless of what waves you've gotten up to in the past, the nature of the five skandhas are the water. Nature of the five skandhas are, they're empty, they're void of any lasting entity. They're void of any self. They're unstained and pure. When you have void, unstained, and pure, that's kind of embracing the full spectrum of the ocean, which is we have to talk about the waves to describe the ocean. But we also have to talk about just the essence of the ocean being the water of the ocean. And that is specifically what this sentence is talking about in the sense of it's basically saying that who you are, your five skandhas, are nothing more than, nothing less than this ocean. You're nothing more, nothing less than this nature of water. The waves come and go, but the ocean never changes. In the sense that the water, the essence, is unchanged by whatever the waves do. So whatever body you have, whatever sensations you experience, whatever thoughts you have, whatever you actually do in terms of activity with your body, with your thoughts, etc. What's interesting about all of this is it can't stain, you can't affect the water in any way. And what's also interesting is whatever you do, you can't get any closer to the water. And you can't get any further away from it. Everything you do is that nature of water. But the thing of it is that oftentimes we're using our five skandhas to kind of grasp after something other than just the nature of what it really is. We're chasing after things that we want to become successful in various ways, or to relationships with various people, you know, to have wealth and status and so on. And all of these things I'm mentioning, they can be, to have wealth and status can mean, well, I just have enough money to make it through the month, enough money to buy food for the week. And just to make it explicit, so in this analogy, this metaphor, the water is what we call variously Buddha nature. That's our, in capital letters, our true self. We call it our true heart. the heart being kind of the center, the core, that fundamental reality that we are. Reverend Master Jiyu used a number of terms herself. One term that she settled on for quite a long time was the eternal, which the ocean is, the metaphorical ocean, by the way. And the word enlightenment is used in two different ways, which actually kind of partake of each other at the same time. Enlightenment oftentimes, in a very common way, gets used to describe that experience that you have where you actually touch and know, like Avalokiteshvara, you know that water, that essence, that true fundamental reality, that eternal reality that we're all part of and are never separate from. And enlightenment is also used for that way that we live our lives more and more deeply, more and more fully over time in practice and training, where less and less and less are we chasing after our desires or pushing away our aversions and keeping the precepts more and more naturally. And in doing that, we actually just live from and experience that deeper nature, that true nature, more and more fully. What's interesting about this first sentence, kind of the fullness of it, is that it's describing this spectrum, if you will, from the waves to the water, which if we don't look at it deeply enough or understand it deeply enough, that's where we keep seeing paradox arising in like Zen statements, you know, statements that the teachers of old would make. And when we would look at it, it's like, this doesn't make any sense, or this is a complete contradiction, a paradox of sort. And yet the nature of life is that it always partakes of the waves and the water. It's always both. And in the common sense, you know, common usage of the word self, which here is referring to, kind of pointing to, you know, talk about yourself, namely me, Gary, Alex, our self is never separate from our true self. And another way of describing it is that actually our self, or our five skandhas, is actually an expression of the true self. It's an expression. Waves are just an expression of the water. If there weren't water, you couldn't get waves. If there weren't a true nature, if there weren't the eternal, there wouldn't be a you. It wouldn't be the five skandhas. And I guess one other thing comes to mind to add to this too, is that the world that we experience, the reality that we experience kind of as kind of normal, average people, prior to a spiritual practice and spiritual experiences, that's the world that is always, always, always changing. Never the same. And we describe that world as, one way of describing it, is the world of appearances. I haven't looked very much, but it's in the back of my mind to try to see if I can find it on YouTube. But I watched this beautiful movie a long time ago. It was animated, but it was based on the fantasy fiction story called The Last Unicorn, which I was studying in a college class, among many other things. And what's interesting is that the scene in the book is that I'll abbreviate it here. Basically, what happens is that these unicorns kind of, they were driven into the sea, and then they start appearing in the surf and come onto the shore. And what was really beautiful was that in this animation, as they had these animated, waves of the ocean, and ever so slowly, the waves would start morphing into parts of the waves would morph into these shapes of unicorns that would then kind of appear on the beach and come out as a unicorn being. But it was just this beautiful, I remember watching, it's like, oh, this is a beautiful way of showing how a wave in the broadest general sense can be seen as it's an appearance of something. You can think of just shaping a wave, shaping the water to look like anything you want. It's like, well, it appears like a human being. These various five skandhas. And what happens is that, through no fault of our own, because of the way we were brought up and what, as we were growing up, and growing up sometimes is even in our 30s and 40s and 50s and beyond, still growing up, is that we were taught to engage with this reality, this world, at the level of appearance. And it's our spiritual practice, when we come across and start engaging in a certain type of spiritual practice, that's when we're taught in various ways, through studying and looking at the precepts and trying to practice them more thoroughly in our lives, through having a regular meditation practice. What that's doing is, we may not know it for a long, long, long time, but what that's doing is allowing us to sort of sink more deeply. We're going deeper. We're not being superficial anymore, and sinking down into the water more, into the essence of what we really are. And seeing and experiencing that, firsthand. How is it that we keep ourselves in the world of appearances? Well, we just keep involving and busying ourselves through grabbing on or pushing away, physically, sensorily, mentally, activity-wise, and so on. We just keep working at the level of appearances. We keep that going. And it's no surprise that that's what we experience then too, because that's the level that we're engaged at. And then along comes, all of you come along, myself included. We go to these folks that have been doing this spiritual practice called Buddhism, and they say, try to be aware when you're grabbing onto something. Try to be aware when you're pushing something away. Try to be aware when you're engaged at the level of appearances. And put down the grabbing, put down the pushing away, and see what happens. And there are times in our spiritual practice when this putting down, this letting go, gets really, really scary. Because the whole basis, our whole approach, our whole understanding of reality is at this level of appearance. And Buddhism is saying, well, stop holding on to that level of appearance. Stop holding on to that level of, stop pushing away that level. And we don't yet know, but Buddhism says, well, yeah, there really is something else there. And there are all these lovely stories about climb to the top of a 100-foot pole and then take the next step. Come to the edge of the cliff and take the next step. Again, metaphors, analogies, these images. You have to talk sort of metaphorically. You have to come up with imagery, stories, to try to convey to somebody how to proceed spiritually. You know, another way of talking about the things we grab onto and push away is that we, you know, those are our, you know, we prop ourselves up in various ways in life. And a Zen master's job is to kick out those props. Oh, you're holding on to that boot. You know, various teachers do it more abruptly than others do, but maybe I'm the type that sort of sidles up to you and, yep, there's a cliff there. There's that cliff edge. Nothing beyond that. Go for it. Nope, leave your parachute behind. Yep, it's scary. It's like, oh, nope, they just ran away. Yeah, that happens too. They look over the edge. It's like, nope, not going there this time. They'll be back. Maybe here, maybe somewhere else. I don't think anything else comes to mind right now to say. So I guess that's my way of saying I think I'll call that good for now.